because you're jumping back into the gap. Outlet to coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. Excited today to have Alan Keene with us. Alan, welcome to the podcast. It's been a lot of fun because you're someone I've followed for a while and come across your name many times, and we've actually had conversations offline. So excited to have you here to talk basketball.
Hi, Chris. I really appreciate you having me on, mate. This is it's a wonderful experience for me to chat with you and to talk to another like-minded coach. And I've really enjoyed your podcast. They've kept me company on a lot of long journeys every weekend and daily to and from work. So appreciate what you're doing, and thanks for having me on.
Well, it's great to hear, and I know as coaches, we have a lot of long journeys, so never hurts to have a podcast. So, Coach, currently the head coach of the Reading Rockets in the British Professional League, and you've been with them for 3 years, and then also you've been within the Great Britain Pathways, going through the system, so to speak, but most recently the under-18 Great Britain head coach for the last 2 years. Prior to that, under-16 head coach, and you know, just some tremendous development experiences, and obviously you've earned your success moving on up within the program. And I believe as well, you're with the Commonwealth game teams there past cycle as well.
Yeah, correct, Chris. I mean, I've been quite lucky in terms of getting into the system. You know, I did the way it works over here in the UK is, you know, we go through like a regional pathway and stuff. And I did a regional team quite a few years ago for a couple of years. And it was exciting actually to move through the pathway with those players I coached from the age of 12 and 13. Those guys are senior players now, and some of them are playing for the senior GB team. A lot of them are playing in Europe or in the US in their final senior years as college players. So yeah, I've been quite lucky. I've had a lot of support. I probably worked a little bit harder than some guys who haven't gone on the same journey or stuck the course just a little bit longer. If I'm being honest, Chris, I find that, you know, success is a matter of hanging on longer than others sometimes. And I've just kept my nose in there, kept my foot in the door, kept chipping away, speaking to coaches like myself and other coaches, and just trying to pick up as much as I can along the way.
Well, some truth to that and stick with itness and all that different stuff. And we'll get into a little bit of your education background as well. And I think it's safe to say that we align with a lot of ideas that we've talked about and that just that I've seen you discuss before. But I want to start right into something that I think us as coaches need to reimagine, rethink, retool, whichever way you want to get to it. And I've seen you post some stuff about this. So talk about some pregame, halftime, some stuff to deal with that, and some of the things that you've done in particular that I've seen that rethink halftime and how we handle that as coaches.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with the pregame and the halftime and timeouts and stuff like that, Chris, you know, for a long time, I've wondered, like, how much value does it actually give to the game? How much value and how do you know it's giving value to the players on the court and the team in general and as a whole? And what I've done to kind of help with that process to have a better understanding of the impact I'm having is I record every pregame, every halftime, every timeout. And I generally watch them. I pretty much watch most, if not all of them, the next morning or later that evening. And it doesn't take long. It takes 15 minutes. But you'll always, even now, like tomorrow we have a game and I'll do the same process again on Thursday morning. And I always find stuff thinking to myself, well, actually, that wasn't a good message, or looking at the body language of the players and, you know, they didn't receive that point well, or there was a look of confusion, or I spoke too much. I didn't let them speak enough. So, you know, if you're asking yourself, what's the value of what you're doing on a regular basis, your pregame, your halftime and your timeouts will be one of them. But I like to give the players a voice, Chris, inside in the change room, especially pregame. You know, we don't do anything in a game that we haven't done in a practice like most coaches will. So I'd often ask the players, you know, what are the keys for today's game? What's important for us? What's urgent? If I allowed you only, well, I've often used this one, guys, if I only allowed you to focus on one thing, what would that number one thing be? What's the one thing that would make the most difference? Okay, what's second on that list? What's third on that list? And, you know, very often they come up with the keys to the game themselves. And I'll fill in any gaps if I feel necessary. Normally it's a scouting report if I have to fill in a gap, or, you know, they haven't recognized something that I think is critical. But I like to give the players a voice in the change room pregame. I'd like to think I allow them to talk more than I do, but the reality is, Chris, I'm not at that stage yet. I would like to think we get there someday. I mean, the academy players I coach at the moment, which are basically player pathways between the age of 16 and 19, players who are aspiring national team players. You know, some have played national team, European Championship, but they all aspire to move on and do better things. With these guys, I'm probably a bit more successful with it because I have them in my academy every day. I work with them every day. So our training sessions will very much develop the skill set of a player to reflect, review, to plan what they're going to do next on the court. So when it comes pregame, those guys are probably a little bit more advanced than my senior team at the moment, because the senior team is basically all new players for me this year. We brought in three guys from the US. We've basically got four full-time pros, one semi-pro, and then the rest is made up of our pathway academy players. So the academy guys are a bit further down the line, just because we live it each day in practice, giving them a choice and a voice and asking them to review and, you know, to analyze what they've just done. And we do that in different ways. We might get into that later in this conversation.
Coach, let's get into that actually specifically, because I think coaches are sitting there going, okay, what's the actual execution of this in terms of, let's say it's halftime? Because, you know, pregame, I do think there's a little bit more of voice given to players, I think, in some places, although I don't think it's totally traditional, but I think it's a little bit easier. Whereas halftime, you know, sometimes there's a time constraint, sometimes there's a urgency to get something communicated. So I think that's a time when you're within the pressure of the game, whether it's a timeout or halftime, where it might be a little bit more challenging for a coach to think this way about empowering their players in conversation or in sharing, listening, fixing, I believe is the terms that I saw that you use. So can you talk specifically, you walk into halftime after you've had a discussion, I assume, with your coaches outside the locker room, or do you go right in and you have the discussion immediately in front of your players with your players?
We always give them a couple of minutes. I mean, I'll always enter the change room about 2 or 3, 4 minutes sometimes after they've entered it. But I'll come back and continue that conversation. But I always ask the physio or a team manager, you know, what did they talk about before I came in, just to see does it marry up with what they say to me anyway when I do come in. But yeah, we give them time to discuss stuff, to review the first half, and just to air whatever they want to air with each other and get it off their chest. And, you know, then when I come in, I'll always ask them, what's your review? And their review has to be based on what they agreed the keys of the game were. So we don't review anything that we didn't discuss beforehand. We do, but the first thing we'll review is the keys to the game. And what layers that and the foundation of the keys, let's say if they decide that rebounding was important, that we've got to win the battle of the boards, transition defense is important because we're playing against a high score and fast-paced team. Let's say they're two keys of the game. What will underpin that, the first thing we'll ask them to review is their behavior. And what I mean by behavior, Chris, is like, did you commit? So if we substitute the word behavior for commitment and intent, that's the first thing we'll ask our players. So did you commit to the keys? Did you commit to the box out? Did you commit to transition defense? Or 3-4 or 2 bigs and 1 of the guards, the deepest guard, with our offensive rebounding principles, we call it a triangle and a 2. With the triangle and 2, did you commit to the triangle? Did we commit to the 2 getting back, short, middle, long, middle? And that's the first thing we ask them. Did we commit to the stuff we said we were going to do? If we did, then we review the execution of that commitment. Was it successful? Yes. Was it not successful? No. Why not? And then we'll review, talk about that one. And then I'll ask them just to review any other business, should it be. So what else is on top of the keys that came out of first half that we didn't plan for? You know, we didn't identify pregame that was important, but it's emerged in the first half. So we will talk about that. But the first, I would say if we break it down into 3 parts, Chris, 4 parts actually, the first part will be the players going into the change room at halftime by themselves, having that discussion, airing. Maybe it's something a bit controversial. Maybe there's a bit of conflict. They need to air that. That's fine. There's no problem with that. We don't shy away from those moments. So we give them those 2 or 3 minutes. Then I'll go in with the assistant coaches and I'll ask them for their review, which I just talked you through. And then I will fill in any gaps and any additionals that they didn't talk about. But before we leave the changing room, before we leave any time out, I try to give them at halftime. It's a lot easier, obviously, because you have more time. But I'll ask them, okay, remind me what we're planning for now. So that will go through that cycle, really, with me filling in the gaps and giving any additionals. But they must leave the change room having said to me, reminded me what we've just agreed to right now. And what that allows me to do, Chris, is, you know, when in the first 2 minutes of the third quarter, if they're not delivering what we asked them to deliver. So, for example, we had a Under-19 Cup final on the weekend. And we shot 19 threes in the first half. So at halftime, I was observing it because it's our academy kids playing at the club level under 18, but I was in the change room. And I said to the coach, look, we're shooting too many threes. And we shot 21 threes in the second half, which went against what we asked them to do. So from that point of view, I said that my review with the coach after the game was, you should have called a timeout after 2 minutes because they shot 2 threes in the first 2 minutes, which wasn't what you agreed at halftime. And when you get that agreement from the players at the end, they're the last voice. When they agree and remind you what they've agreed to, then you can hold them accountable to it in the first 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes of the third quarter.
Coach, this is really fascinating stuff. And I think this is something that I'm talking a bit about rethinking and reimagining how we handle these things. So just to review, the four things are the players get time on their own. You go in and then you review the things that you agreed upon at the beginning of the game. And then three is there's some type of group interaction. And then four, planning for the next step, which is what you're going to do going out to the second half. Is that the basics of this?
That's correct, Chris. I'm just going to realign you with three and four. So the third phase is me filling in any gaps. So Second phase is that we have that discussion, but they're talking, they're leading it. I'm finding out where they are, what they're thinking. And then the third part is me filling in any gaps that I think they left out. That's important. And then the fourth part is them reminding me what we agreed to do moving forward.
This is great. So now the example that you gave is wonderful about first 2 minutes of the second half. They aren't doing what they agreed to do. So now it's your job as a coach to hold them accountable. Let's just go back a little bit and say, because I know some coaches will be asking, how do you handle conflict in a locker room in an open environment like this where open discussion is allowed? Because certainly in traditional coaching, think it's, you know, when players don't have a voice, players don't have a voice to disagree with each other, nor do they have a voice to disagree with coaches. Whereas in a lot of these open environments, and I know I've had this in my locker room before, and I welcome it, players sometimes disagree. So how are you handling this conflict if it arises in that first phase of halftime?
Well, there's a couple of ways I could. There's a couple of things to what you just mentioned there, Chris, that I'm going to get into. Number one is, like, if you know, if you're a listener to this conversation we're having right now, and you know, you're an inexperienced coach and you're thinking, well, actually, I like this and I'm going to try this too. I want to be very clear that this is no different to, say, running an offense. Like, say, you run a set play. We practice this in practice. We practice this from day one, from the right up until the end of the season, in practice, in every single drill we do, every single activity we do. It's not just something that you turn on and turn off game day and allow the players to have a voice and a choice and to reflect and think and to be self-regulated and to be able to realign themselves and recalibrate themselves, and not just themselves, but each other. That stuff we work on every single day in practice. So the principle I just gave you about players talking and communicating as much as the coach, if not more, we try to bring that to life every single practice. So this is a skill set they're developing, the skill to analyze, the skill to reflect, the skill to communicate effectively to different teammates. Now, they don't always get it right, just like us as coaches. And, you know, sometimes it does blow up in the change room and there is a disagreement. But, you know, I'm going to talk to you about a thing we use called the rule of three in a moment. But when it gets to three, that's my job as the coach. I'm scanning, I'm listening, I'm sniping to see what they're coming up with. And when it gets to a point that I feel I need to step in, that's my job as the coach to step in, realign it, pull rank if necessary to deal with a conflicting moment. But we haven't got there a lot because I think of how we've, because of how we've layered it, how we've developed it, how we've nurtured the practice environment in order for them to be able to do it in pressured moments during the game. And that's not just in timeouts. That's not just in halftime, Chris. That's also live on court in the moment. We do a lot to do with live solutions, which we can get into in a moment. So we don't avoid the difficult conversations. We don't avoid the conflict. We're okay with it. We like to air it, get it out, and then just recalibrate everyone. But it takes, the coach has to decide when does he step in. And that's no different to Brad Stevens, I would imagine, or a master coach, what I would call a master coach. They know what button to press at the right time in order for that to be the solution to the issue or the need in that moment.
Coach, let's circle back then. So for coaches listening to this, what are the benefits? Why should I consider doing this as a coach versus me just telling them what to do?
Great question. And you know, I love this question. I'll tell you why. Because I think what coaches need to understand, and I say coaches because I talk to a lot of coaches and we have this type of dialogue. And you know, I'm going to tell you, Chris, you know, I didn't always coach this way. Let's call it an athlete-centered approach. Now there's different things you can call it. Actually, I like to call it a needs-based approach more than an athlete-centered approach, because I think the athlete-centered approach is a little bit misunderstood by coaches at the moment. It's effectively what's the need of the player in this moment. Sometimes the player needs you to give them the solution. You need to give them the answer because it's critical for them in that moment. Other times, we can allow them to fail, to have a voice, to have a choice, all that stuff. But for me, the benefit with it and the sell and the value is that when the game is on the line and the player is in live play, This is just my personal philosophy. I don't have any evidence to back this up. I don't have any empirical studies. But for me, it just makes sense from a common sense perspective. When the game is on the line or in any given moment in live play, I don't believe when a player is on the move, about to make a decision, I don't believe my voice from the sideline, if he can hear it, depending on the environment you're in and where the proximity of where he is on the court, I don't believe my voice can influence that player to make a decision live, in the moment, under pressure, out of his comfort zone, for it to be a successful outcome. So my support, the reason I back this, and I'll always back this way of coaching is, and my purpose is, I'm trying to develop better decision makers on the court who can be self-sufficient, who can self-regulate under pressure, and who are poised under pressure and at their best in these moments. It's a long-term process. The easier thing and the thing that makes us feel better as coaches is to be on the sideline, giving the solutions, giving the answers. There's different reasons why I think coaches do it. I think there's external reasons. I think there's reasons where that's part of what they've always done or that's what they know. And I think the external ones can be very heavily influential, especially if you're coaching a pro team and the owner's watching you or the fans are watching you. Or even if you're an under-16 coach or an under-12 coach and the parents are on the balcony watching you. You know, I think when we step back and say the players need to be talking and communicating as much as the coach, that can often be perceived as the coach not doing his job, because traditional coaching is we're on the sideline screaming and shouting, giving all instructions, basically controlling the player like you would in a PlayStation. So for me, to summarize, Chris, the real sell and the value is to develop self-sufficient athletes who can make decisions, effective decisions, under pressure, and make the right decision in these moments.
Well, in this, and I 100% am there with you and agree with this. And you said something that's really important. There's so many things that we do, and I can only speak to basketball coaching, but I'm assuming in coaching, that we do simply out of tradition, that the expectations are you do this as a coach, so this is what you're supposed to do. And I'll give you another example, is even where we sit on the bench, and we've gone to this year, that I sit in the middle of the bench. I don't sit at the end. I don't remove myself from my players. I didn't invent this. I saw some other coaches do this, and I just had a thought process and said, if I'm truly, one, trying to immerse myself with my team and the experience of the game, then I need to put myself in a position where I'm feeling the heartbeat of the team, which is one in the middle of the group. So there's players on both sides of me. And when I used to sit at the front of the bench, the other thing is that I found I was far more negative because I was surrounded by coaches. And coaches tend to buy in rather than when I'm sitting near players, I find my language changes completely. And I think it's been very valuable for me so far as an exercise. But I think, well, why did I used to sit at the front of the bench? Well, because that's how people always have done it. And no, that's think about all those different things in coaching. And, you know, and I love how you're thinking this. And I'll let you comment on that. And I don't know if you've seen that before, or you've thought about that in terms of those things.
I've seen it and I have thought about it. You know, I haven't done it. And if you ask me why, I can't answer that question. I've just gone along with what I've always done. However, you made me kind of really think about past experiences I've had, that when you're sitting with, surrounded by your coaches, assistant coaches, and your performance analysis, or whoever sits at the top of the bench with you, you just reminded me of sometimes that can be your biggest barrier to the type of coach you want to be. And I'm quite lucky currently where I am and with the coaches I work with in a national team environment that I don't have that experience, but I think we facilitated the environment where that's not going to happen anyway. So the message and what story I want to share here is, like, I'll speak about my national team assistant coach, Ian McLeod, who works with Newcastle Eagles in the professional league in this country. We formed an agreement, you know, when he first came on board, I said to him, you know, Ian, for me to be at my best, I need you to be at your best. And you being at your best is helping me to stay emotionally balanced. So one of his roles as the assistant coach was to recalibrate me, to help realign me when he felt my emotions were upsetting the team. And that was his first and foremost role. Now, it wasn't like, you know, he was my minder and, you know, he had to baby me on the sideline and stuff. It's just in moments he thought I was affecting the team by shouting or laying into them a bit too hard in timeouts or whatever. His job was to kind of remind me that, you know, I gave him this role. He's not, I'm crossing the line kind of thing. So we formed an agreement on that one. But in order to do that, we had to invest a lot of time when we came together. And I've done it with my club coaches as well, where I would give them permission to critique me, to analyze me, and to say, you know, this is what I thought, this is how I thought you coached that game. We do that after every game anyway. We always have a WhatsApp group with the coaches, and we'll always review the game in three tiers. We'll always review ourselves. So coaches, for example, we review ourselves first, then the team, and then the coaches we worked with. So I would always have to be the last. I'm always the last one that does that task, so I don't filter how the other coaches are thinking. We do the same with the players, by the way. It's just on a different WhatsApp group. All the players have to review the game or the practice with themselves first, team second, and they review us as coaches. So I sit up that end, but I feel very supported, like, in terms of how I am on the sideline because of the guys around me and what we've built and what permission I've given them to challenge me. Now, that breaks sometimes if I actually dismiss the coach, but I try to invest enough time to build a relationship so strong that in those moments that I do cross the line doubly, let's say, so I'm emotionally imbalanced with the players, the assistant coach tries to realign me, I have a pop at him or dismiss him. I feel that we've invested so much time and that we can manage those moments as well where the assistant coach doesn't get disheartened and so forth and so on. But yeah, in addition to that, Chris, I'll share with you, the player's name is Jacob Brown. He plays in Spain at the moment. You know, he's 19 years old. He was with me in the European Championships two summers ago. And we were playing in the European Championship semi-final, so it was quite a big occasion for all of us. We ended up getting to the final and we lost to Croatia in overtime. But in the semi-final, Jacob was the captain. Jacob and Nelson Bocci-Yadim, these were co-captains of the team. So before we went to the Euros, I set these guys down and I said, look, guys, I think I affect this team in some ways with my emotions. And I said, what I'm giving you the same permission I'm giving my assistant coaches. If at any point in time you think my behavior in the sidelines affected me, you've got a right to come and say to me, coach, this is one of those moments. And I said, what that will do for me should help realign me to get back to the state of mind I need to be in order to help you guys be the best you can be. And it didn't happen at any point. And we get to the semifinal and we're playing Estonia in the semifinal, quite a tense game to start with, considering it was in Estonia as well. And I opened the game, a bit anxious, quite a little bit emotional. And we get to around the second period and Jacob's sitting on the bench and he comes and he grabs me by the hand and he says, coach, this is one of those moments. And in that very moment, Chris, I completely realigned myself so much better than if any assistant coach had said it to me, because it came from the player and it came from who I'm trying to help and it came from who I need for us to win. It came from the guys on the court who are doing the job. So I think you can set up certain ways. I think there's certain things you can do in order to facilitate that type of environment you want, to facilitate the type of people you want around you for you to be the best version of yourself. But I think you have to be ultimately very honest with yourself in order to do that first.
This is great. And again, by no means do I suggest that coaches should sit in the middle of the bench, but what you're bringing up is exactly what I have always had as a strength and a weakness, and that's my competitiveness. And finding what you've said is emotional balance is so important. And that coming from players, that coming from your assistant coaches, that coming from a location, whatever it may be, for me, this process, it makes me a better coach. I know I'm a better coach when I'm less emotional. So this is awesome. But I also want to point out a few other things that you said there so coaches don't miss them. Number one, you've used these terms consistently throughout, permissions and agreements. And again, so much of a part of this alignment with your players are active participants in this process, and that you seek permissions or agreements with them and vice versa, so that the process of coaching them is this shared process. And I just love that terminology. I think that's so important for coaches that we align ourselves in that way with players. And then the last thing I want coaches to have noticed in that, what you said, is the WhatsApp group or however you do it, that your coaches have a place to review each other, to comment with each other, but your players also have a group for themselves and a group where they interact with coaches. Is that right? There's three different groups?
Yeah, that's correct. I don't know if there's a players group. They may have one, and I'd be really cool with that. I've got no issues with that, but I don't know if they have one. They may do, but we do have a coaches one. We do have a players one, but the review process is always the same, Chris. It's always whoever does the review, player or coach, you must review yourself first, your performance, then the team as a whole, and then the coaches. So, you know, a player review of me would be a player would review himself first. How behaviors always come first, though, Chris. So in each of those three areas, the player would always review whether he was above the line of acceptable in terms of commitment and intent with what he chose to do on the court. And he would elaborate a bit on that, which would become a technical tactical discussion. Then he would review the team as a whole. So it would be team defense, team offense type of stuff, and review the behavior of that commitment intent. Then inside that would be the technical tactical. And then the final thing the player would review is the coach's performance. And you know what, Chris? I mean, I'm happy to share with you anytime, man, by email. I can send you some of these reviews if you want. The players, sometimes you'll read it as a coach and it'll humble you pretty quick if you've built the right environment. They were coming back to me early in the season, which is normal. It's the same every year. They come back with, yeah, the coaches did a good job with this, this, this. You know, by the time you get to Christmas, if you built the right environment, they're telling you the coach did a bad job. He's too emotional on the sideline. You were talking to the refs too much. I was confused about what you wanted coming out of the timeout in the third quarter. I just needed more clarity on that one. Or they'll say stuff like, I needed you to give me more of a solution when you didn't in that moment. And that allows you to have great discussions during the week, pre and post practice. But if you built the right environment, those reviews become, they actually become your session plans for the following week, potentially, because you'll find out pretty quick where these guys are feeling vulnerable in terms of stuff you're covering in practice. You find out stuff from your assistant coaches about how they're feeling about, you know, their roles, and then they'll give you stuff about, you know, the team and stuff like that. So for me, the reviews probably one of the best things we have, and the most, other than the video, I would say the WhatsApp groups are the most powerful tools we have this year.
I love it. And it just gives you such a platform, as you said, for planning and for improvement, and just generally everyone knowing that the focus is just on us being better. And it's not simply an outcome basis, right? And that's the tendency, no matter what, for coaches, you know, to a certain extent, oh, you won, everything was great. You lose, everything was bad. And this helps you find a balance in that too, because everything's just about that process of getting better. So I love that. I love that. And so many places we can go here, Coach. And I want to circle back a little bit to what you said about halftime, but you're handling your timeouts this way too?
Yeah, the principle will always be to make it a bit more succinct, Chris. Player first, player last. So I don't get it right, Chris. I mean, my players will be the first ones to tell you, you know, this is still a work in progress for me. And, you know, the scoreboard does play a part because I coach in a performance environment. You know, our academy is a performance environment where these guys are all trying to get scholarships to the States or play in the national team or go to Europe. And our pro guys, like, they don't come here to retire here. You know, for our Americans at the moment, we've got three guys who came over from playing NCAA. Like, they didn't come to Reading to retire. Reading, they're trying to move on to better things, maybe a higher league in Europe. So,
of course, yeah.
The thing is for us, like, you know, yeah, so it can be a challenge on that one, and to not play the scoreboard. But that's the reality is I'm trying to stick with the process, and I'm nailing it probably. I'm nailing it more than 50% of the time. I'm just not nailing it 100% of the time. But in the timeouts, yes. So the players will come in, first 10 seconds, right, bang, guys, review what's critical. And it can only be one or two things. I got to cut them off sometimes because they start talking too much and going off on tangents. And I say, right. And I'll sometimes just show my fingers, like a 10-second count. They're used to it now. They'll see each one finger come up at a time. You know, that's 1 second, 2 second, 3 second, 9, 10. All right, stop. So they review 10 seconds and talk about the one or two critical areas. If I think they've nailed it, then I'll fill in a gap for the next 30, 40 seconds. And then very often I'll ask them, okay, well, review real quick before you go back out. What are we going out with? What's on the front of our mind? What's urgent right now? Some timeouts, Chris, I'll just come in. I'll say, right, guys, this is my moment. I'm taking control here. Bang, bang, bang. I got to draw something on the board, whatever it may be. Again, it goes back to why I said to you, I believe in a needs-centered approach more than an athlete-centered approach. And that's me making a calculated decision. What do they need in this moment? And sometimes I'll just tell our captain, like our captain, Danny Carter, has just been such a useful resource for me this year. I mean, it's his last year. He's a veteran. He's played 4 years at Stony Brook. He's been a pro for a long time. Very intelligent guy. Come a long way. His journey has been incredible in terms of how he's changed his behavior on the court and just the way he's become a leader and a captain. But very often, as he's walking in timeout, I say, Danny, look, here's what's important. Here's what you guys should be talking about first or before they go in the change room. I walk in his direction. I say, Danny, like, when you guys have your time right now, this is what you guys should be talking about, just to make sure they can be more succinct to the point.
Well, and you mentioned that when we talked about halftimes, that there's a queuing. And I was going to ask you about that too, is even with taking this to scout, taking this to practice, there's a certain amount of control a coach has by queuing players about what the right conversations are or about what the right focus points are. That's a part of coaching. It's making it seem like it's the player's idea, which is very valuable. And at the same time, making sure that you get your coaching points across. And it's much better when it comes from them.
Dave Smart is one of the best coaches in the world. And now you can learn from him with never before available access. 3 all-access practices and 1 defensive coaching clinic are available at davesmartbasketball.com. What makes these all-access practice and clinic videos so unique? Dave Smart has won 12 national championships and has a winning percentage of 92%. Dave Smart's Force Weak Hand defensive system is world-renowned and has never been shared in this way before. Dave Smart has a winning record in over 50 games versus NCAA Division I teams, having beaten Wichita State, Baylor, Wisconsin, and many others. Dave Smart is recognized by Jay Wright, Mick Cronin, Jay Triano, and many other top coaches in the world as one of the best minds in basketball. Learn from one of the greatest minds in the game who opened his doors and shared the game with us from one of the most successful basketball programs in the world. Go to davesmartbasketball.com now to learn more and to purchase all 4 videos.
Yeah, absolutely. And can I just say as well, Chris, like, you know, underpinning all this, and I think it should be brought to everyone's attention or anyone who's interested in trying that way of coaching, you have to be very clear on that there may be a lot of pushback. There's a couple of things. There may be a lot of pushback, and it's a patience game. You know, this takes quite a long time to do effectively. And not I'm talking from a coaching standpoint, I'm talking from your players, because, you know, my experience, especially with the senior players that we get, and no disrespect to USA, but to the US basketball system, but mostly the American guys we get come over here, I find it is quite challenging to get them to have a voice for themselves. I think most of the guys have told me that I've been in contact with over the past 3 or 4 years, that they were not used to being asked, what do they think? What's their, you know, to do a review. They want to be told what to do. And, you know, it was really interesting. One of our Americans this year, who's just turned out to be a fantastic player, and he's flourishing with this type of coaching at the moment right now. And he wants to be a coach. And I think this style of coaching is inspiring him even more, which is really satisfying for me. The first thing he said to me after the first week of being here, he's like, Coach, we got to talk. I need you to know that, you know, for the past 4 years, I've been told to do these 3 or 4 things. You're asking me to review what's happened in the last 10 seconds. You're asking me to review what's happened in the last phase of play. You know, you're asking me what was good, what needs to be better. You're asking me what would I do differently, if anything. And I'm really struggling with this type of system. And, you know, I had to sell the value into him. I had to sit down and invest time with him and say, look, AJ, here's why I think this way of coaching can make you a better player, because it's ultimately going to make you a better decision maker. And we talked about what decision making was. You know, I think it's going to make you a more skillful player. And we had to talk about what skill is, skill, like, you know, perception and action coupling type stuff. I had to explain to him and educate him about that the choice, the decision comes before the action. So it's not just your ability to shoot, pass, and dribble. You actually have to make a decision whether to shoot, pass, or dribble. And decision will always come before that. So we spent a lot of time, and he soaked it all up. And right now, I mean, we put a GoPro on the guys sometimes just to see how much they're communicating in practice. And when I put a GoPro on him in one of the sessions and I looked at it the next day, he was awesome. Like, he started reviewing other guys. I heard him saying at one point, like, Trey, what happened in the last 10 seconds? Talk me through that. You know, he started using some of the terminology I was using, which was great to see. But my message, Chris, is it's a process that takes a long time to get right. But it's also a process that coaches need to understand. Your players are going to be on different levels with this. Some will take off right away and they're confident and they're brave to do it. Others, it'll take a little bit longer. And I think that's the challenge with it, as opposed to me being on the sideline saying, bang, here's the answer for everybody. One size fits all. Right. We're dealing with different players at different stages of their learning.
Well, and I was going to ask you exactly that, which is some of your imports who have not been brought up, say, through the pathways or, you know, through the system. This would be completely foreign to them. So I'm glad you addressed that. And the other part, I mean, obviously we're aligned with so much of this in terms of philosophy, but the other part that relates to timeouts is that since an overriding principle of this is empowering your players to have freedom, that I'm imagining there's a tendency to let your players play through challenges, play through some difficulties, and to have them figure things out a little bit more rather than to try and control the game from the sidelines. Mm-hmm. Is that a fair point?
Yeah, I mean, and I'll give you an example. Again, it could be another tool that somebody could apply just from listening to this conversation. Try it out. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. Go back and try it again and be patient with it. But in order for us, we've talked a lot about the players talking in the changing room, talking in timeouts, okay? Now, what we do in practice is every drill we start, I'll always tell the players at the start of the drill, let's say we're working on playing against switching man-to-man defense, you know, and I'll say to the guys, okay, for these next 20 minutes, we're going to run our stuff and blah, 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 blah. And then I'll finish it by saying each team has one timeout in this 20-minute segment. So we get our players to call a timeout in the practice and to run that timeout. And all I'm doing is moving between both teams, and my assistant coach is moving between both teams to listen to what they're talking about. And sometimes we have to realign them and bring them back to what the success criteria of that segment of practice is. So, I mean, most coaches probably do this. I don't really know, Chris, but, you know, in every drill we do, every activity we do, we have a defined success criteria that we will share with the players, unless we're checking recall and we're checking it covertly, which we can get into in a moment. But we will share the success criteria unless it's a recall segment, like I said. And then we don't tell them what it is. We just see what they do. But so when we share the success criteria with them, we then tell them, right, here's the drill, bang, bang, bang. You have one or two timeouts in this segment, both teams. And then we time it. So if it's stuff we haven't spent a lot of time on, I'll give them 1 minute for a timeout. If it's not new content, it's not new learning, it's stuff we've done for quite a while, I'll give them 30 seconds timeout. If it's only one thing, so it's not major, I might just give them a 10-second timeout. I'll tell them how many timeouts, how much time they have for that timeout, but then we may have to realign them on what they're actually talking about, because very often they'll call a timeout, and the success criteria was defensive components, defensive elements, and they start talking about offense. So we just go over and remind them, okay, what's the first thing we review? First thing they should be asking each other, like, if they committed, they can review the success criteria. The other rule we have is, when they call a timeout, if one of them says, right, did we commit? Did everyone here commit to what we're doing? If somebody says no, that's the end of the timeout. There's no 30 seconds to talk about what they're going to do. Bang, they go straight back out there. We do not review it unless you committed to it 100%. Otherwise, we're effectively reviewing poor practice. We're effectively reviewing a 50% effort, which doesn't allow us to get better anyway. So my message here is, Chris, we do this in practice. We have to do it in practice to help them to become better at reviewing. Ultimately, what you're doing is helping them to have an economy of words. You're helping them to use a basketball vocabulary, which has to be succinct and to the point, because live, we can't have conversations. You know, we use it all the time as coaches. We'll talk in phrases and we'll talk with, you know, terms and terminology. And, you know, there's an economy of words there for the skill of a coach. I'm trying to do the same thing with the players, because when they're running back on defense and they're taught and the game is live and something wasn't right on offense, I want them to be reviewing each other, running back the floor and just giving the solution, but it's an economy of words. So these timeouts that players call in practice helps to develop these areas that they will use in game, whether it's changing room or whether it's a timeout in the game.
Well, I'm glad you addressed that, because that's another part that I know coaches practically would want to understand, because you mentioned that you practice this in practice, and that's gives them a better feel for how this all unfolds. Because again, it doesn't just happen. The first time they experience this can't be at halftime of a game. This is absolutely something that's developed and refined within practice. And it's amazing, all those little things that we do that help us develop a team from within. And that's an outstanding example. So
can I just share one thing that ties into this, Chris? I've shared on our previous podcast, and I'll share with you as well, because it ties into this quite well. We got our guys in, the senior team I coached with this year, the Reading Rockets senior team, we got all our guys in preseason in August. So mid to late August. Our first game is like late September. So we have about 4 weeks. And, you know, I told our guys that, you know, we didn't do any classroom stuff and sit down and go through presentations and do any motivational stuff and set up the season like this is how we're going to do it and all this stuff. Because my experience of that in the past is short-lived, and you know, I'd rather bring it to life first and then give them the poster after and say to them, hey, this poster is what you've been doing, okay, as opposed to giving them the poster and the phrases and the motivation and then go and bring it to life. So,
Coach, just to interrupt, I could not agree more. That's a great phrase, and I want coaches to hear that. Bring it to life. Bring it to life and then discuss it later. Because, again, so much of the stuff we do in classrooms don't connect at all to the game.
And correct. And I think that word you just used there, I mean, we could go off in different tangents with that word connection.
For sure.
Because without that, you've got nothing. But anyway, our guys came together in August, and I said to them, when they walked in the gym, shook their hands, met some of them for the first time, we had two returners and the rest were all, and it was a makeup of pro players and our better academy players who were on a GB pathway or college pathway to the States, let's say, in next year or 2 years or the year after. So 17, 18, 19-year-olds. And I said to them, guys, you have to earn the right for me to coach you tactically. And I said, that's all I'm going to say to you right now before I put you into this first task. And I said, I'll say it again. You have to earn the right for me to coach you tactically. So, of course, I mean, that goes over everyone's head and they probably think I'm some big crazy guy and don't know much about coaching or whatever. So, you know, you have to ride the storm early and, you know, build the trust by being patient and relentless. And they're two key words as well, I think, that I try to live by daily in many things. But so that was the first thing. You got to earn the right to be coached tactically. And then the activity I put them in, we warmed up. We split two teams at a whiteboard on two ends of the floor. Red team had the white team's names on their boards, and the white team had the red team's names on their board. And I constructed three columns, and in each so, and I told them, right, we're going to play 5 minutes. After 5 minutes, you're going to go to your whiteboards, and you're going to write down the strengths and weaknesses of the guy you were guarding or your opposition, basically, between you all. So we played 5 minutes, you know, they're going up and down, they're doing their thing. They have all previous experience, so they understand spacing and timing. You know, we didn't have to give them any offenses or defenses. They understood the basics. They know what they were doing. And we played 5 minutes, bang, go to your boards. They started writing down strengths and weaknesses of the opposition, player by player. And I said, right, back in, you're going to play another 5 minutes. And now you're going to, after these 5 minutes, you're going to go back and fill out the third column. And the third column is your game plan for each player you're going against. So what I was forcing, and then we did this for about 25 minutes. So every 5 minute period, we would stop and let them go back and they would change the strength of the weakness and the game plan in the fifth period, as opposed to the first period, because they obviously saw the player more. And what this set the tone for us and it really set the stall for is, I'm going to force you to analyze and think about what you're doing and why you are doing what you're doing. And I'm going to force you to analyze where's the strength and weakness of the opposition you're playing against. Because when the month of January, February, March, April come around, that's what you're going to have to do anyway, live with or without me on the sideline. Because I ultimately want you to make better decisions in the moment based on what you're going against, not what you currently think you can do. Well, what reality is. Reality is you can't post that guy up because he's too big, too strong, and you haven't got the toolbox to go against him. So what are you going to do next? So, you know, that was the very first thing I started with them. And we didn't put in a set play. We had played like three games and before we put a, you know, started putting a playbook together. You know, I think it was October, maybe by the time we started really coaching, started introducing tacticals. So from August and September and most of October, it was all about getting them to commit and to review and reflect on what they did. It sounds crazy. You know, I'm not going to tell you we're sitting on top of the league because we're doing this stuff. The reality is, you know, we are where we are and we're ready when we're ready to win. And that's not going to be something I'm going to get hung up on. The owner of the club might have a different perspective on that one. And he's cool as well. You know, he understands my philosophy. And the thing is, like, this is a patience game. I think the players long term will come back and thank me in 5 years' time when they go out and have different experiences. And hopefully I've helped them along the journey to develop their decision-making process, which ultimately effectively makes them a better player. But the key component to this, Chris, is you've got to have synergy within your team. And when I say within your team, I'm talking all coaching staff, owner, physio, team manager. You know, I think you got to be very open and honest as a coach to how you want to do what you're about to do, because they're going to go on the journey with you. And if there's no synergy within the staff, then you're always going to break down at some point.
Yeah. And it's so true in all this. And I think coaches who are listening to this can see that, like, it's not just one part of your philosophy, but the sharing, listening, fixing concept exists throughout everything that you do. And that example at the beginning, you said, bring it to life. As you're telling me that example, I think almost it's shocking their systems to get them to understand the value, not only of their input, but of them thinking in a different way. And it's not just we're going to spoon feed and give you the answers, that you're part of the solution. And I think it's outstanding. And I think it's a great way to be able to get your players thinking.
Well, the thing is, Chris, like, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, when ultimately you ask a coach, look, what are you trying to give your players? What are you trying to do for your players? I'm trying to make it easy for them. And it sounds crazy because they're struggling with this and they're finding it difficult. But I'm trying to make the game easy for them in the long term. So we train hard to fight easy kind of philosophy. So I'm selling it to the players. Look, these are difficult moments for you because they struggle with it. But they're actually, right now, I'm really enjoying it because they're so into it and they get it. And they're actually becoming quite competent with it, with the process. So it's very difficult, like August, September, October, November, especially for my assistant coach who was new to this. I have a new assistant coach, the senior team. He was very confused by it because he was going on the same journey as the players because he's never done it before. But it's ultimately to help the players. I want to make it easy for the players. I want to make the game easy. And the best way I can make it easy for them is to enhance their decision-making.
Coach, that's great stuff. And what it brought up for me is this concept of scouting report, self-scout, the self-scout that your players do at the beginning. It gets them thinking right away a little bit deeper about strengths and weaknesses. And I think to some of my players in practice, and they can practice against each other, say 30, 40 times, and sometimes they still let one of their teammates go to their strength in practice. And just how difficult that process is, that we think it's really easy. We give players a piece of paper, we give them video, or we explain it to them, and we just expect them to be able to execute a scouting report. Whereas that's a really difficult process, especially when we're talking 2 days to get ready to play a game or whatever it may be. So is this process that you go through, has it been beneficial for your players in understanding and applying scouting reports a little bit better?
There's no doubt about it has, because we start, like you talked about, the first phase of that four-phase process pregame I spoke about when we go in the changing room, or the second phase when it's players' time to talk to me or to each other. First thing they'll do pregame is they will give the scouting report back to us as coaches. They will say the tendencies of the players on the court. They will share with the group the team tendencies, the offensive tendencies, the defensive tendencies, where the opportunities lie, where the risks and the threats are. They will give all that back. So they're practicing that process anyway every single week. But more recently, my assistant coach started putting the scouting report on a Google Doc and sharing with the group and telling them to input certain things, like input how you would go against this guy, how we're going to attack him, how we're going to shut him down, what we're going to take away, what we're going to give up. And so they're contributing it in that way anyway. I mean, and with the national team, we've actually got players to do scout reports, you know, just to see how theirs before we even gave them. So we'd give them a couple of games, tell them to scout it and go in, come back, and then present it to the group. We'd rotate it around so they could. It's always surprising. Like, I've always said this, the player not necessarily knows more than the coach, but the player has a unique perspective. And that unique perspective is called feeling, I think, where they're going to feel it. So when you feel something, you're a lot more invested in it. So your perspective on it could be a little bit more unique than if you're not out there as the performer, you're the spectator. I mean, we all sit in front of NBA games and critique them and say, how, you know, what's that coach thinking? But the reality is when we're out there and we're doing it and we're feeling it, it's a little bit of a different perspective. You don't have that, the vision may not be as clear sometimes. So, I mean, from my experience with the players, Chris, is I've always got more back from them about what we could have done better or what we should do than anybody else. And an example of that would be, you know, at the end of every season, we all do this, ask our players for a review or whatever. But when I come back from the Euros, I always ask the players to email me. I never do it by phone or by email, even though we speak once a week on the phone leading up to it. And there's a lot of contact. I always ask them to email me. What did I do well? What could have I done better? What could we have done with the program? What did we do well with the program? What could we have done well with the program from all perspectives? And it's always been the stuff they've given back to me has always superseded anything that any performance, we have a performance directors as national team, it's always superseded any point of view the performance directors have. And I've had a great performance director who's been an outstanding mentor to me for the past few years, who's now moved on, Vlad Andruskovic. But the player's feedback has always been of more value and more useful to me in the future moving forward. So why would you not ask them to scout? Why would you not ask their perspective when they're the ones that have to go on the floor? And in this day and age, like, every player knows every player in their league anyway. You know, these players will probably know the opposition in our leagues. You know, they, all their games are on crossover. You know, they all know each other. They've all played with each other in the summer, you know. And I think it's no different to any other league in any country at any level, that the player will give you a different perspective and a different point of view. And ultimately, the player has to go out there and defend that player and play against that player. So they'll ultimately tell you where they feel they're weakest and strongest against that type of player if you ask that question also.
Well, I think the depth of that conversation necessary. But I believe as coaches, we need to rethink scouting reports. Like, after being around so many NCAA, NBA teams and seeing the documents they produce and seeing the data they produce and seeing... Yeah. It's really a make work project to a certain extent. And I'm curious, and I know you spend a lot of time in this thought space too, is what actually transfers. And yeah. I'll share an example with you that I had good fortune of spending some time with the NBA staff recently. And one of my questions was, how does a 16-year veteran account, or how does he enjoy scouting reports? And of course, he's not going to enjoy them if they're done in the traditional sense. And I was really encouraged when the coach said, well, we get a different player every day to present some aspects of scouting report. Mm. And I was really encouraged because I haven't heard that much at the NCAA or NBA level. And it's exactly what you're speaking to, is that empowering your players, making them feel part of the process, but also using their knowledge, which is unique. That's not our knowledge. Knowing is a lot different than doing. And when the players, as you said, feel it, they do it, that's different than us knowing something. So that's an outstanding point that I hope coaches take home. And coach, maybe in a different conversation, we'll have that whole reimagining of scouting reports. But any thoughts just briefly on that?
Well, in terms of reimagining scouting reports, I would challenge the way we present them. Like, I think we've touched off that, so I'm not going to relay that. But the traditional paper or video, I've gone away from it this year. We don't present players with any paper scout. We don't present them with any video. We put a video in a WhatsApp group if they watch it. We don't watch video anymore together.
We don't either.
And the reason being is, like, you know, as an assistant coach, I've set in those scouting reports. I've set in those videos like hundreds of times, and I've never felt inspired, motivated, or I've never felt, you know, enlightened. They go on a bit too long. You know, we do it with the national team because we play 8 games in 11 days, and, you know, it's a kind of an accelerated process, but we'd make them no longer than 15 minutes. We try to get in, get out. We send them a link to watch themselves, you know, and that's it. But with my club team and academy team, we stop watching scouting reports. The only video we watch, and we do a lot, is video on ourselves. We scout the hell out of ourselves, and the players are a lot more invested and interested in that one. We do a lot of one-to-one video. I'll sit and watch a video, but we go through the same process, Chris. I don't sit there and dictate to them. I don't sit there and just reel off what I see and what could be better. The process is the same. Player first, coach second, player last. So when we sit and watch video one-to-one, or we watch it as a group, it's no different to being on the court in the practice. The process doesn't change. We live it every single day. We're trying to keep it alive every single day.
No, that's great. And for coaches, we post video to a private Facebook group for our team. And then, like, obviously on that, you can somewhat see if people watched it or not. But really, I don't really know if they watched it. The only way to know that if they watched it is obviously we ask questions or engage them in conversation, or they apply it. So those are things. But
can I make a point on that one, Chris?
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, if my guys don't watch it, I'm going to look to myself and think, what have I not done that he doesn't understand the value of watching that? You know, I'm never going to go to that player, you know what, you should be watching this video, da, 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 because that doesn't carry, that's not going to help. It doesn't mean he's going to watch it for the reason to want to. He's not ever going to get out of it what I want him to get out of it if he feels he has to watch it. You know, I want him to want to watch it. So again, it goes back to how you selling, for me personally, I'm talking about, how do I sell the value? They're the type of questions I'm asking. Have I sold the value of what we do to this player? Because if there's no perceived value, even us as adults, Chris, think about it on a day-to-day basis. If there's no perceived value in what we're doing, then we're probably not going to commit to it. We're going to do it because we feel we have to do it, but we're probably not going to commit to it and do it as well as we could do. No different for the player.
Well, that's so true. And that's why, I mean, we keep it very short. We keep it very specific. We focus more on us, as you've alluded to, because again, that's far more interesting for my players. And I'm sure for most players, is they want to improve. They want to improve themselves first, the team as a part of that. But definitely there's that component that they individually want to improve. And then we get them the same way that you're talking about, that we get them to review and comment. And if you see our Facebook page, that you'll see that when I post a video, that I will always ask a question or two with it, and players will engage in conversation about that. And then that helps me go to scout or next practice or whatever it is and say, okay, this is what you guys are saying. So here's us working on exactly what you're saying. So it connects those things together for them. So, which is basically what you're saying as well, is that it connects so many things for them.
For sure. For sure.
Coach, again, there's so many things. I've enjoyed this conversation, but I wanted to get to something that you've brought up with me personally. We've talked about a little bit, and that's, how do you know a drill or a skill transfers? Because this is a common question that I get, and I'm sure you get this to somewhat. People that operate in this games approach to coaching place, or this focus on decisions place, how do we know something transfers?
Well, I think the panic button that always gets pushed is they don't do it well. So we step in, We take away all the stimulus, all the stuff that's real, and we ask them to do it by themselves. And I think there's an element to that which is fine. I have this conversation all the time. I don't like to use cones. I don't like to do any drills that are unopposed. And unopposed doesn't mean that opposed, doesn't mean it's one-on-one, full pressure. But, you know, at the end of the day, we're going back to what skill is, Chris. And, you know, I mean, we're singing from the same hymn sheet about that one, you know, that it needs a perception and followed by an action. It needs, like, the skill itself is not the action of shooting. That's a technical action. But the decision to shoot, the decision comes before the skill. And, you know, I've heard you say that one before, and I've picked that one up somewhere a couple of years ago as well, but it's resonated with me since. And I think the decision-making element of a skill is just as important, if not more important, than the technical execution of the skill, because you can't execute the technical if you're not in line to make an effective decision. So whether to shoot the ball or not to shoot, depending on the proximity of a defender. Now, if you're asking me, how do we know if that skill transfers to a game? I would say if there's stimulus on the court, be it a clock, be it a defender, be it half a defender, be it a constraint, be it a half a body, full body, and we're executing the skill in those conditions, then I'm quite confident and I'll back myself that that will transfer to the game. You know, I've had this conversation with my players very often at the academy. They say to me, coach, look, we'd like to do more skill work. And I've had to educate them on what a skill is. And skill for them was taking out the rebounding nets and bouncing the ball off the net, attacking the rim, finishing 1-0, and just repping that loads of times. Now, the issue that we as coaches have with that one is there's no doubt that the player can improve without the defense, can improve a pattern, because that's effectively what you're practicing. You're practicing a pattern, a prescribed action. You will have a lot of success with a prescribed action than you will with an unpredictable action. However, when there's defense on the floor, every action is unpredictable because we don't know what the defense is going to do. But when you practice that skill in isolation, the player improves that pattern, that prescribed action, probably, I don't know what the numbers are, but I would say 50 times quicker than if there was a defense on the floor, because there's no pattern, there is no prescribed action. It's a reading of the defense, of the decision you have to make. So for me, anything that involves defense, now you can constrain the defense and say, put them at once, give the offense a half a second or 1 second advantage, or the defense is coming from different angles, behind, in front, all your drills, all the stuff that you've published. If you're telling me that that's involved, that stimulus is there, I would say that skill will transfer to the game. If you show me the drill that it doesn't and you're repping that, you're an under 16, under 18 performance level player, or an under 14 competent player, or an eight-year-old competent player, then I would say that without the defense, you're not getting better at what's real, what reality is.
Well, I like the way that you've described that, because again, it's simpler in the terms that you're saying, which is for as a coach, really, again, don't spend much time worrying about that as much as focusing on what's the stimulus that you're putting in front of your players. And is it the game-like stimulus that happens in the game? And if it is, then it's going to transfer. And that helps immensely in terms of a coach focusing on the right things and spending a lot of thought process on that. So that's great.
Just to be clear, actually, it's funny we're having this conversation, because we practice on a Tuesday, we practice twice. We practice morning and evening. I mean, this is our performance academy and Division I men's guys. And I spent the first 10 minutes this morning of an hour practice doing 1-0 post moves. And we did it as our warm-up. Mm-hmm. And after that warm-up, bang, it was straight into 1-on-1 post moves with the same moves. So we do the isolation stuff, but it's in a warm-up, Chris. We wouldn't do it in the body of a practice.
And coach, and again, I think you're the same. Like, people misinterpret. I am not anti-isolation. I'm not anti-drill. Absolutely. I am anti not connecting those things to the game. Mm-hmm. And people spend too much time in that space just doing the drill over and over again in the same way without connecting it to the game or the isolation.
Yeah. And that's always the challenge. And that's always, I think, where coaches like us, like-minded coaches, like the way we're thinking. I think that's what we'll always argue is, what's the percentage of time? Now, the isolation is an important part if it's learning new stuff. If you're teaching advanced footwork, you know, you may have to give them a feel for it. But that feel changes, even if it's just an angle of where you put your foot when the defense is out there. So it's the percentage of time. I have an issue with the percentage of time that coaches are spending on isolation work. You know, we call this stuff individuals. This is an individual session. It's not really, because it's 45 minutes of non-contextualized activity.
Yeah, no, that's great stuff. And Coach, I mean, again, I can't thank you enough. I think people could kind of figure out that we could go on and have great conversation, and we will have this again. But I love the concept of this podcast, really diving deep into kind of one or two subjects. And I've never done it before where we've dove deep into kind of rethinking and reimagining pregame, halftime, timeouts, or whatever. So I'm really grateful for you giving us really practical ideas about how to rethink them and stimulate coaches thinking about what they do and how they do it, and saying that, look, you don't have to follow tradition just because tradition's there, right? Think differently, and then think about what's best for your players, as you said, needs of your players. So thank you for taking the time.
My pleasure. I'll leave you on these two last ones, Chris. Question for coaches out there, and you know, by all means, maybe the answers will come back through you. First one is, how do you start your practice? And how do you know your players can remember what you've previously covered in a practice last week or a practice 4 months ago? So how are you starting your practice, and how are you checking recall of previous learning? And the second thing I will say is a statement. It's not a question, that the video is your best friend as a coach. I've got so much from the video, as much as I have from the players' feedback. And an example would be a younger coach in our country who reaches out to me week to week. Billy Beddoe's his name, and he's really bought into the fact of using a lot of video in his practice, and I think he's seen real benefits of that. So the video is your best friend as a coach. Don't shy away from it. Just get it up there, get it going, and it'll help you once you're honest with yourself.
No, it's great stuff. Great advice all the way around, and wonderful for you to take the time and share, Coach. All the best with the rest of your season, and for any coaches that want to connect with you, I know you're pretty good on social media, so I'll post that in the show notes as well, and make sure that you follow Coach Keane as well on social media and connect with him.
I appreciate this, Chris, and thank you for the opportunity to talk basketball.
All the best.
A quick interruption to this week's episode to let you know what you're missing if you are not currently a member of BasketballImmersion.com. Basketball Immersion is one-stop shopping for video learning to stimulate your basketball coaching using evidence-based practices. Watch hundreds of videos covering BDT shooting, zero-second skill training, how we teach using small-sided games and a games approach to coaching, as well as team concepts and systems like trail trap, flow offense, two-sided fast break, and much, much more. NCAA, NBA, pro, high school, and youth coaches are amongst the thousands of coaches who are a part of our community. Go to BasketballImmersion.com today to stimulate your basketball coaching.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at BasketballImmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.